some of you will remember that about 6-9 months ago, we tried to broaden our discussion of the presidency to examine the whole area of governance, and central to that is the connection between the presidency and Congress. We have, as part of that governance series, with retired Justice Lewis Powell and others, looked at the relationship between the court and the presidency, but haven't gone as far. When we entered that area, we thought this was a fairly unemotional and scholarly subject, but we didn't do any, we didn't allow for columns such as one that appeared recently in the Wall Street Journal saying taking stock of the presidency, and among other things observing that the only relief from the humidity in Washington is that members of Congress have left town.
Less hot air,
right? The calm before their return is a good time for President Bush and his advisor to look back and see where they've been and where they're going. If they are due, they will be struck by the continued deterioration of the presidency as an institution. It is weaker now than when Mr. Bush found it 8 months ago. So we have a hot subject, and one that is very much on people's minds, on which passions run strong, and it probably is important, therefore, that we sit back and study and reflect on the subject, because whenever blood runs too hot, why, that's the time usually to stop and think, truly think about consequences. Fred Kaiser has concentrated on this subject for a considerable period of time. Dean Rusk used to talk about making a subject your parish, and congressional executive relations certainly are his parish. And as a specialist in American government in the Congressional Research Service, at the Library of Congress, he's been involved in the analysis and the discussions and consultation and research on the subject, also organizing conferences and participating in numerous discussions. He's the author of a number of important subjects on congressional control of executive action, oversight of foreign policy, and various other topics, most notably for the Miller Center, a recent excellent piece in the Annals on congressional oversight. And if all of you are good and behave yourself and don't ask too many embarrassing questions, he'll be glad to share after the session a copy of the article with each of you, if you care to have a copy. He was born in Salem, Oregon. He did his undergraduate work at Cornell and his graduate work at Pittsburgh. Taught and lectured at Pittsburgh at several institutions in Pennsylvania, at Georgetown, the University of New Mexico, and at places like the Federal Executive Institute in Charlottesville. He received several awards, an outstanding performance rating at the Congressional Research Service, a research grant from the Dirksen Congressional Leadership Research Center. He received speakers awards from the U.S. Department of Agriculture and other agencies. He's worked either on the staff or with the House Government Operations Committee, the House and the Senate Intelligence Committee, and the Government Operations Committee in the House. So he's had a wide range of experience going well beyond even those committees, and we're delighted that he's come down today and will talk with us on this very contentious subject. I thought last night, as we listened to John Dingell, with the director of FDA, that these passion matters depend on whose ox is getting gored. And for some of us, I might, to be courteous, might say over 50, why the question of question of generic drugs turns our passion in the opposite direction from the Wall Street Journal.
So, again, it's not a matter of age, it's a matter of mileage.
I blame gravity on my life.
Well, Fred, we're looking forward to it.
Thank you for that wonderful introduction, and I hope I can live up to whatever expectations you folks have. Before I start, CRS, the Congressional Research Service where I work, always asks us to provide a disclaimer that anything we say that's embarrassing is attributed only to us personally, and everything that we say that's insightful and articulate is attributed to the Congressional Research Service. But I do want to emphasize that although I work for the Congress at CRS, we're part of the legislative branch, there really is no party line, if you will, in Congress. There's Congress, one of the fascinating things about working there and studying Congress is indeed its diversity, its heterogeneity. In fact, I'm reminded of that famous line by Will Rogers when he was asked if he belonged to an organized political party. And he, of course, said, "No, I'm a Democrat." Anybody who works for Congress can use that same line in talking about their employer collectively. I'm here to talk, though, about a certain aspect of congressional executive relationships, congressional oversight of the presidency and of the executive branch. And indeed, as Kenneth had mentioned, I have an article here that I'd like for you to take a look at afterwards, and if you have an opportunity to read it and tell me what you think about it in the mail in the future, please do so. I'm always appreciative of hearing different viewpoints and interpretations. Oversight itself, though, has changed remarkably over the past two decades. In fact, just 20 years ago, at the end of the 60s, commentators, scholars, and members of Congress themselves were complaining that Congress was not doing enough oversight, that there were too many cozy relationships. We had this long-standing Democratic control of the House and Senate, Democratic control of the presidency for two administrations. Even when we went back into the Eisenhower administration, he was very much a man above partisan politics and certainly didn't use his Republican allegiance and affiliation was not certainly an intense one. And so we had this, again, a complaint that Congress was not doing enough to oversee the executive branch. And indeed, it was the concept and the word oversight lent itself to hyperbole and jokes and puns, oversight being Congress's neglected function. And indeed, there was a group of essays written or under the editorship of Melvin Laird, a member of Congress at the time and later to become Secretary of Defense in the Nixon and Ford administrations. Melvin Laird had edited this book of Republican letters, if you will, in which this article appeared about Congress's neglected function. Much later, now 20 years later, we're seeing criticisms that are 180 degrees different. For the most part, the criticisms are that Congress is too much involved in oversight, that it gets involved in even micromanagement of the executive branch. In fact, last year, in the aftermath of the Iran-Contra investigations, then Vice President George Bush delivered a speech in Washington in which he accused Congress and the courts both of trying to run foreign policy. That I think his line was that we don't need foreign policy made in congressional subcommittees or by grand juries. And he went on to point out Congress's predilection, as he saw it, for micromanaging, getting involved in the details of administration. And as an outgrowth of that, we've even seen a couple of books by the American Enterprise Institute and a few other institutions detailing an imperial Congress. We used to be worried about an imperial presidency. Now, we're worried about an imperial Congress. Although I must admit, I never thought we had an imperial presidency. We had imperious presidents, there's no doubt about that. But that's a far leap to get into the imperial institution. Just likewise, we really don't have an imperial Congress. In fact, I see the two charges as contradictory. If indeed Congress was imperial, if it were running roughshod over the presidency, and if it were determining policy through public law and through its own activities and operations, it wouldn't need to micromanage, if you know what I mean. My point is, why get bogged down in the details of administration if you, as an institution, in this case Congress, is so powerful that you can set public policy? You wouldn't need to resort to those kinds of almost petty nitpicking approaches that are often involved in congressional oversight. The concentration on small areas, on narrow aspects of public policy. Again, as I see it anyway, it seems to me that there's an inconsistency, basically, of these two charges. Micromanagement on the one hand, and the Imperial Congress. There certainly have been times in our history where we have had an Imperial Congress. In the era of Reconstruction and the immediate aftermath of the Civil War. And that was a real powerful Congress. And if we have to look for examples of Congress being the dominant institution, maybe imperial even then is too strong. But all we need to look at is that kind of a period for comparison, where a president was almost impeached for failing in part to uphold laws that were clearly unconstitutional. That was the bane of Andrew Johnson's administration. And then later on, when you had fairly weak presidents like Ulysses S. Grant, and Congress could dominate public policy making, could tell him who to appoint to political offices, and who should be running the cabinet and what policies he should be advocating. Now that was a real period of dominance. And even later in the century, when Woodrow Wilson in 1885 was looking at congressional government, as he titled his graduate thesis and later his book on this first 100 years of the United States Congress. He entitled his book Congressional Government not only because he was looking at the way Congress governs itself, but also the way Congress was governing the nation. And he was, in some cases, very critical of this dominance by Congress. For instance, when he talked about or discussed the Senate's treaty-making power, meaning the power to ratify treaties, he referred to it as the treaty-marring power of the United States Senate. And he later recognized that it probably had that his words were prophetic, because as you know, when he became president and tried to get the Treaty of Versailles through the Senate following World War I, he was unsuccessful at that. So his analysis at that time, in 1885, proved to be prescient about 30 years later. But there certainly have been times where we have had one institution clearly dominating over another institution. What I think we tend to have now is more of a balanced approach. Both institutions are powerful. That doesn't mean they're equal, or it doesn't mean that they are equally powerful in certain policy areas. That's the other thing that we always have to bear in mind in looking at this wonderfully complex political system that we have. It depends very much on the policy area. Agriculture policy has been dominated by Congress and indeed a few congressional committees, curiously enough named the Agriculture Committees, for eons now. And presidents tread very warily when they want to make dramatic changes in agriculture policy. Other policy areas are much more competitive, much more or can even be, again, dominated by the president. So in this case, we recognize that policy areas also have to be, and kept in the back of our mind when we look at whether or not we have one institution dominating and running roughshod over another of the political institutions. But behind all of this, though, I think in terms of oversight and just the way the whole U.S. system of government operates is not just the Constitution, but the principles underlying that Constitution, particularly the checks and balances. And when we look at the Federalist Papers, James Madison's writings especially, but Hamilton's as well, but James Madison's writings in the Federalist Papers that looked into the checks and balances system, we recognize this important notion that he said in one of the Federalist Papers that ambition must be made to counteract ambition. The rationale there is you needed two fairly powerful institutions to keep reins on one another, and that you should expect conflict out of this. That is an integral part of the checks and balances system. He had this, if I can locate it quickly, this wonderfully convoluted line that came out of the Federalist Papers. I love to read the Federalist Papers because I write like that. I still think we should be writing the way they did 200 years ago. Before we had people like Ernest Hemingway telling us we need to write for 10-year-olds, and I know most people don't agree with that, but anyway, I do. But here's what Madison said, how the checks and balances system works. It works by so contriving the interior structure of government as that its several constituent parts may, by their internal relations, be the means of keeping each other in their proper places. And in all the subordinate distributions of power, where the constant aim is to divide and arrange the several offices in such a manner as that each may be a check on the other. Well, anyway, checks and balances is what he is talking. Ambition must be made to counteract ambition. That's not only why we have two separate political institutions keeping out the Supreme Court, elected institutions, the presidency and the Congress, but why they are on different timetables, different schedules for election, different constituencies, different districts that they represent. Indeed, it's why Congress itself is subdivided into two chambers, why there is bicameralism, why there is a Senate whose members are elected for 6-year terms and run in staggered elections, only one-third of them up every 2 years. And that means all of them won't be running when the president runs for election, of course, but only one-third of them will, and another one-third will be running in the off year. And that's why we get from different states a Democratic and a Republican senator. We get that kind of division, even though we're talking about the same geographical entity, the same electoral constituency. In reality, we're not. We're talking about a different electoral constituency. That's why we have, for instance, a Republican, Alphonse D'Amato, as a senator from New York, and a Democratic Daniel Patrick Moynihan from the very same state. They agree on a couple of issues. It's hard for me to think of what they are on. But they also disagree on other issues, and they come from the same state. And it's why we will find some states with practically an entire Democratic or an entire Republican contingent in the House of Representatives, others with deep divisions in those contingents to the U.S. Congress. And of course, again, all of this has come about by design. This is what the framers intended. They wanted government to be divided, to be dispersed. They wanted power not concentrated in any one hand. Least of all, I think, the executive. And that's where oversight comes in. Because it's the executive that on the one hand, two hands, has the power of the sword. It is the president who is commander-in-chief of the armed forces, for instance. It's also the president who executes public policy in the executive branch that implements and executes public policy. and that gives tremendous power over the rights and liberties of citizens. And again, as I'm sure most of you are aware, that was the great fear of the drafters of the Constitution, that there would be some sort of a majority tyranny that would run roughshod, that would take advantage and abuse the rights and liberties of the citizenry. And you needed to protect those individual rights and liberties against the encroachment of government. And the way you do that is to subdivide power and put checks and restraints, particularly on the institution of government, the executive that's likely to reach out into the general public. Again, remember, this is the Constitution was drafted by people who had had an experience of what they saw as monarchical or executive branch tyranny here in this, here when we were colonies and under the thumb of the British monarch. It probably didn't help presidential promoters like Hamilton and others, that King George, the monarch who was identified with executive power, was not entirely stable emotionally and mentally. And so when we read in the Federalist Papers the criticisms of abuse of executive power, we periodically will see mention King George mentioned and the British monarchy brought up, of how extreme that can become. And again, too, all the checks that are placed on the executive by the Constitution. The president, for instance, is, of course, as I mentioned, the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. But Hamilton, writing in the Federalist Papers, says, don't take that too far. All that means is he's first general and admiral, and that he doesn't have the power to declare war, and he doesn't have the power to raise and support armies. Those are powers that are consciously given to the United States Congress. And indeed, those are powers that the British monarch held in his own hand. He didn't share them with anyone else. Now, granted, he often needed money and had to go begging to the Parliament for that. But the power itself to raise and support armies and to declare war, as well as to be commander-in-chief, was held by one person in the British system at that time, and that was the monarch. That was not the case here in the United States under the new Constitution, consciously divided. Congress was also given powers in interstate and foreign commerce, specifically. So it has a whole variety of constitutional powers that are given to Congress to constrain and check the executive. And part of those materialize into congressional oversight. It's really an implied power. There's nothing in the Constitution that gives Congress the authority to oversee or investigate the executive. But several Supreme Court rulings have recognized that this is a legitimate power of Congress. Congress can investigate the executive. Congress can require information to come from the executive branch about its operations. Congress can call upon not just any executive branch employee, but that is a right that Congress possesses, not because it was granted explicitly or expressly in the Constitution, but because it's implied. How else will Congress know whether it needs to pass new appropriations to carry out a program or an operation or a policy, unless it knows how that program is being run currently, unless it has accurate, authoritative information? How can Congress know whether a new person should be confirmed, for instance, in a position of trust and influence in the executive branch, unless it knows how those programs are already being run by the predecessor who has been running those programs, those offices, those departments? I know I was just reminded in our chat, a chat with Ken earlier on, about the great hue and cry over Congress's rejection of the Tower nomination. George Bush has just come into office, and certainly one of the most important cabinet positions is the Secretary of Defense. It ranks as one of the top three positions in the cabinet, along with the Secretary of State and the Secretary of the Treasury, and perhaps two, the Attorney General. But three or four, obviously, is, and sometimes it may even well be the preeminent cabinet position, especially in the contemporary era. HUD, for some reason, isn't any longer in that category. But the Department of Defense clearly is one. And I know there were obviously a lot of criticism. Why can't the president have his own man in that office? Well, indeed, one of the things Congress, in this case the Senate Armed Services Committee, did was to look into how Tower had behaved while being in an executive branch position, while being on a presidentially appointed commission, and also, too, looked into what was wrong or what were some of the problems in the Defense Department. One of the serious problems that was undercutting support for new weapon systems and the expansion and development of the United States military was the scandal associated with procurement of those new weapon systems. The inability of them to live up to their expectations or how to get off the ground, literally in some cases. There were too many problems that had this earmark to them, that Tower was seen by many people as not the right person for the job at the time, not only because of his behavior on a presidential commission, but also because of his cozy relationships with a number of defense contractors. I don't know that there is anybody who is displeased now that Dick Cheney, also a former member of Congress, is the Secretary of Defense instead of John Tower. There may be some people out there. So when we look at the role that the Senate plays in, for instance, confirmation here, that's indirectly and in a small way in this case tied in with its oversight of the executive. I think one could argue that the Senate, and particularly the, in this case, the Democratic Senate, did George Bush a favor in forcing him to reconsider and rejecting the Tower nomination and selecting someone else in his place. In this case, Dick Cheney. So. Anyway, I've gotten a little off the track. One of the themes I would like us to keep in mind, too, here is that when we talk about congressional oversight, this ability of Congress to review, monitor, and supervise executive branch activities and operations, it also can be seen in something as seemingly remote from traditional oversight as the nomination process. We usually think of oversight as investigations of things that have already occurred. Monday morning quarterbacking, that kind of thing, is what we usually think of oversight. Review after the fact. If there's a scandal, Congress will investigate it, closing the barn door after the horse is gone. The HUD investigation now is a good illustration of what we generally think of as oversight. But it can also mean a much broader understanding. It can also have a much more concurrent and ongoing interpretation. And indeed, one of the criticisms I think that can be levied with regard to the HUD scandal, or earlier too, the Defense Department procurement fraud scandal that's still unfolding in the courts, is that Congress didn't do enough oversight, that it did not monitor these operations thoroughly, and that when, for instance, Congress passed legislation 4 years ago setting up a new position, so-called, in the Defense Department, it was kind of called a weapons procurement czar, an assistant secretary of defense who had authority to look at all weapon systems across the different services, Army, Navy, Air Force and Marines. When they were doing any weapon systems procurement, he had authority to delve in there to make sure that they were following proper procedure. Congress should have paid more attention to that office. It created the office and assumed it was going to work miracles all on its own. Well, first of all, President Reagan took a year in appointing someone to that office, which suggested how high of a priority it had in the in his administration. Then after somebody was appointed to it, I'm sorry the name of the person escapes me right now, he resigned in protest because he could not get the cooperation of the service secretaries. There were a few red flags there alerting Congress that there was more investigation to be done, that more, you had to do more than just set up a new office and hope for the best. You needed to reinforce that office. You need to give it political clout. And that is part of the reality of congressional oversight. It takes a lot of effort and energy, and there may not be any payoffs, or you may make enemies. And although sometimes we see Congress, it appears that Congress likes to make enemies, and it's digging up the dirt, washing the dirty linen of somebody else's dirty linen, preferably out in public. It's not, the members of Congress usually are very reluctant to do that, and they're extremely reluctant to take on the president and his top advisors, even when he's of a different political party. It's not a fair match. It's Mike Tyson going into the ring, the president on the one hand, against a sparring partner. Any one member of Congress, even committee chairman, even the Speaker of the House, even the Senate Majority Leader is no match for the president. And it's rare that Congress is united and unified enough to combat the presidency as an institution. Congress, as I mentioned before, is a very decentralized body. Power is dispersed. It's not shared equally, and it's rare that it's united. And consequently, that means when a member of Congress may take on the executive, he may find himself, or she may find herself, leading a non-existent corps of troops. He or she may find themselves out there very much alone. Or when they challenge the executive, they'll do it on a very piecemeal basis. We mentioned the investigation by John Dingell's subcommittee, oversight subcommittee, on the generic drug industry and how FDA failed to inspect and monitor the generic drug industry properly. That is the kind of exposure that we normally see in congressional investigations. They're very limited, they're very narrow, they're focusing on one particular operation. And when we see even challenges, oversight investigations that are highly controversial and contentious, or that deal with controversial policies, we often attribute more to them, I think, than there really is behind them. A good example of this, I think, is the Iran-Contra investigation. If I may bring up a mild, placid subject. When we look at that, we fail to realize that this was part of, this was one aspect, the helping of the assistance to the Contras in Nicaragua, the rebels, as kind of a collection of a variety of groups who were opposed to the Marxist regime in Nicaragua that had coalesced on that one common assumption. They wanted something done about the Sandinista government. They wanted it removed. They wanted a change. That was this collection of rebel groups. And in part, this was an outgrowth of a very long-term policy that President Reagan had called the Reagan Doctrine, which was to support and provide assistance, particularly military assistance, but not exclusively that, to rebel groups in developing nations that were governed by Marxist or communist regimes. And this was the one of these programs that we have learned about in the meantime, or projects, that was here in this hemisphere, in the Western Hemisphere. Others occurred in Cambodia, for instance, in Far East Asia, or Southeast Asia, and others in Africa and Angola. But if we look at the whole gamut of the Reagan doctrine and congressional oversight of that and investigation of that, what do we find happening? Congress supported the president's programs in every one of those cases. Or if it was, even when they were controversial. For instance, there was a scandal associated with the money that was supposed to have gone into Cambodia to some counter-revolutionary groups. No one could find the money. It disappeared. It went into drug trade. It went into arms that were then shipped or sold elsewhere on the black market. Half the money that went over there, supposedly, according to some press accounts, got lost. And Congress still continued to fund that program at the request of the administration. In Angola, there was a 10-year ban, a statutory ban on aiding the rebel groups in Angola, even while Cuban troops were there supporting the national government in that country. At the request of Reagan in the early 1980s, Congress withdrew that ban, changed the law, and allowed for CIA covert operations to commence again in Angola. In Afghanistan, in fact, Congress tended to prod the administration to do more than it was doing. And the reason we have found out about that is because some of Congress's prods were questioned by the administration. It turned out to be that when Congress and, again, fairly conservative Republican senators, at this time the Senate being in Republican hands, the first 6 years of Reagan's administration, thought we weren't doing enough because of the Soviet invasion. In fact, they had thought that Reagan's program in Afghanistan was a come down from what Jimmy Carter had been doing. And indeed, there are some justification to the argument that President Reagan was carrying on the speak loudly but carry the small stick notion, reversing Teddy Roosevelt's old axiom, at least with regard to Afghanistan and the Soviet invasion. Because what President Reagan had done, for some domestic political reasons, had been to remove some of the economic sanctions that Carter placed on the Soviet Union. So, as a way of compensating for that, Republicans in Congress were prodding the administration then to do more directly against the Soviet troops in Afghanistan. One of those programs was to send Stinger missiles to the rebels in Afghanistan. As I say, that made it into the press and our attention because of a leak from the administration complaining that these Stinger missiles are very valuable items, worth a lot more than the $10,000 or so that each one costs, and they may not even be used by the Afghan rebels. We don't know that they even know how to use Stinger missiles. They need to be trained. It's awfully difficult to train people who you can't find in the hills. Just where are you going to leave these Stinger missiles? How are you going to get to them? So there was a leak in the press complaining that these Stinger missiles, they'll be gladly accepted by the Afghan rebels, but probably sold to their religious brethren in Iran and other countries, and maybe even used against the United States down the line. Of course, we didn't know at the time we were already selling missiles to Iran covertly. But that, needless to say, didn't materialize until a couple of years later. But here we are with Congress, again, not only accepting the basic premise of the administration and maintaining oversight, this kind of watchfulness of the program, but also endorsing movement, furthering the program in the same direction that the president had requested. And then when we come to the Iran-Contra affair, we recognize that in some ways this is an aberration. It's atypical of the way Congress had reacted to what are normally very controversial programs, covert operations. And the cutting back finally the withholding of funds in 1985 and 86, prohibiting funds by statute from being used to fund the Contras in Nicaragua, and then that causing people in the administration to circumvent the law and solicit private donations, both from Americans as well as foreign governments abroad and foreign potentates, and also to get funds from the sale of weapons to Iran to divert to the Contras in Nicaragua. Okay, the generation of that, though, that is has to be kept in mind. And indeed, when we look at Congress's investigation of it, in some ways we have to it's easy from this perspective then to understand why Congress was so upset. Not only did the administration break the law by diverting those funds, but also Congress was intentionally misled about it, and indeed elements in the executive were intentionally deceived and misled about it. The Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of State, who presumably ought to know something about what's going on in foreign policy matters and military matters, were kept in the dark about key aspects of the program. Then Vice President George Bush, who was a member, statutory member of the President's National Security Council, was kept in the dark about key aspects, and the President himself has consistently and uniformly denied that he knew about the diversion of funds to the Contras originally, early on. That was kept from him. Poindexter, so far, who is the National Security Advisor to the President, has confirmed that. He said he did not tell the President. And so Congress is upset, not only because it was deceived, but key elements in the executive were lied to, deceived, and evaded, and indeed to the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Again, military men who ought to know something about military policy and ought to be involved in such determinations and decision-makings, if only as advisors, were kept in the dark about that. We heard recently from Colin Powell, who was now President Bush's nominee to become chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and was President Reagan's last national security advisor, arguing against military aid for the Contras. So this is not, the conflict there does not lend itself to a military resolution. And this was the kind of argument that people like Poindexter and Oliver North were avoiding in the executive branch by closing out the Joint Chiefs of Staff at that time and closing out the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of State. They might well have heard those kinds of conflicting viewpoints. And indeed, too, that gets us back to oversight. That is one of the reasons, one of the arguments in favor of Congress maintaining what Woodrow Wilson called the searching oversight, and what is in a public law, 1946 Legislative Reorganization Act, called continuous watchfulness. That is one of the virtues or one of the benefits that is seen in oversight, that you do get a second opinion, that when there is a problem, or you hope to head off problems, but when there is a problem, you hope to get an opinion of an institution that's not necessarily wedded to the policy or not necessarily committed to it. And that is, again, one of the virtues to save the administration, too, from making mistakes. When Dick Cheney, now the Secretary of Defense, was on the Iran-Contra Committee, that was one of the arguments that he had given in testimony. He said, first of all, or in one of his statements, he said, first of all, it's just stupid to avoid reporting obligations and requirements to Congress, because you first of all fail to notify your own supporters of what you are doing and then cut them off. They cannot argue the case for you before competing viewpoints in Congress. Secondly, you can't develop consensus in that way. And then thirdly, because of these first two failings, you undercut the president's legitimacy and credibility. And thus, even if you have a short-term, narrow success, other things come unraveled, other programs and policies can become unraveled, because you have sacrificed the president's power, Ronald Reagan's power as a particular individual, George Shultz's power is tremendously sapped by the revelations of Iran-Contra, not only his power domestically and, say, politically influential with Congress, but imagine what it did to his influence and his credibility and prestige internationally with heads of state and his counterparts in other governments. They must have sneered. He said, I'm representing the president on foreign policy matters. And they said, and you didn't know about selling weapons to Iran? Or you didn't know in advance about diverting funds to the Contras in Nicaragua? How do you know what's going on in this field as well? And so that was the gist of Cheney's remarks at the time. By excluding Congress as well as other elements in the executive, you end up jeopardizing the presidency itself, and indeed the power of individual office holders. Well, I've kind of gotten away from the basic narrow focus of congressional oversight, but I think it has to be seen in this broader context. And of course, I've tried to put a very good and rosy glow on congressional oversight. It's only a noble purpose. It's only to save, to make democracy safe for the world, as I like to think of it. It's to check and restrain abuses of the executive branch. It's incumbent upon me and my own credibility to recognize that sometimes a couple of individuals in Congress do get carried away, use oversight and investigations for crass political purposes, sometimes even to embarrass executive branch office holders. Don't ask me to name any names. I won't. But indeed, that is one of the things we have to put up with. It's not much comfort, I know, to executive branch officials to tell them that this has always happened. I was on a panel a few months ago with Clarence Thomas, the head of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission and quite possibly forthcoming member of the appeals court, if he gets confirmed by the Senate, U.S. District Appeals Court, a man thought very highly by first of all, the Reagan administration, and of course now by George Bush. But Thomas came in for a lot of criticism by Congress over his handling of EEOC and the way its policies had changed. But he recognized, I know, disagreed and who disagreed with him, though was very much above board. And they said, these are the policy questions we are concentrating on, and we think you should be going in this direction and using these methods and approaches, not the ones that you're advocating. And although he disagreed with what that committee was advocating, he, though, respected them for the way they went about conducting oversight and recognized that they had some legitimacy. And indeed, the members of that committee broke the law 20 years ago that he was implementing. So he had to recognize that they had some legitimate claim to understanding how the law ought to be implemented. But I did point out to him that when he was complaining about unfair treatment he got from one of the committees that looked at his at the EEOC on a regular basis, I said he was in good company. And Alexander Hamilton, our first Secretary of the Treasury, was hounded from office because of the complaints and criticisms by Congress. Looking not only in the way he ran in the Treasury Department, that wasn't bad enough, they looked into his personal finances as well, because there was speculation that he was speculating, or that his cronies were speculating, based on information he gave them about Treasury policies that would help his wealthy
or hope to become wealthy cronies in New York State, and that he down the line might be receiving largesse from these very same people. It was never proven, but the rumors were circulating that that was the case, that Hamilton was taking his advantage of his office. And here was this man, a luminary, politically speaking, in the United States, one of the most powerful people never to occupy the presidency or a position in Congress, certainly one of the most influential people we've had in our history, hung up from office by Congress. But that's another part of the story and another part of the theme. It wasn't just Congress, of course. Congress doesn't operate in a vacuum, nor does the presidency. Where was Congress getting its ammunition? Who was permitting the Jeffersonian Republicans in Congress to take on Alexander Hamilton? That's right.
Thomas Jefferson,
George Washington's Secretary of State at the time. So we recognize, too, a lot of what we see Congress doing, the conflict between Congress and the executive, is often reinforced or, in fact, produced because of conflict that exists already in the executive. It's already there. It's a policy conflict. It's positions, conflict over positions of power and influence. It's a lack of unity that exists already in the executive branch. And Congress sometimes, not always, of course, but sometimes is reflecting that when it challenges the executive on something. So what we're saying is, even if we removed Congress from this system of government, not an easy thing to do, but even if we did somehow pass an amendment that removed Article 1 of the Constitution, and therefore the first branch of government, as conservatives like to want to point out in the 1960s when they were challenging Lyndon Johnson's great society programs and calling on Congress to do more to restrain the executive then, that Congress, even if we remove Congress from this whole scheme of things, we would find a lot of the same divisions continuing to exist, the same conflicts, maybe less intense, but in a different political arena by definition, but they would still exist. There would still be the same conflicts between a Thomas Jefferson and an Alexander Hamilton. He said government ought to be going in completely different directions.
Do you think there's any merit to the Wall Street Journal for its own presidency deteriorating, or do you think it's just bearing out the soundness of Madison's observation that you quoted?
Yes, I think I would say that there sometimes is this pendulum effect that we see. Ronald Reagan just left office after 8 years, was a personally powerful president, popular certainly to win re-election, staying in office for 8 years. We haven't seen that since Dwight Eisenhower. Presidents have left hurriedly for a variety of reasons and have never completed two terms since now almost a 30-year period. And so we had this buildup of presidential power under Ronald Reagan, and indeed too, he had the advantage for at least 6 years of having the Senate controlled by his own political party. So looking at the Reagan presidency versus now the first 8 months or so of the Bush administration, obviously Bush is not as powerful as Reagan. He didn't win yet re-election himself. He just won election the first time. And although that's no mean feat, he did not bring with him a Republican Senate or House. It's still a Democratic Congress. So he is challenged, or his challenge is more difficult than when Reagan entered office in 1981. Secondly, Bush is not the same person as Reagan, not only personality-wise, of course, and politically, intuitively powerful, the way people like Reagan and John Kennedy and FDR, Teddy Roosevelt were had kind of an intuitive grasp for political power and used the office of the presidency, as Teddy Roosevelt called it, the bully pulpit. Bush, for the most part, is not of that type, so he doesn't have that same kind of charisma. And then finally, Bush is a former member of Congress himself and is much more conciliator than Reagan was. Reagan had a certain agenda and very much a change in direction of public policy from his predecessor. He ran against an incumbent and defeated an incumbent, Jimmy Carter, and so he emphasized differences and had this political agenda. Bush was running as the heir apparent to the Reagan administration and so didn't fight the same kind of battle. So we have a whole series of factors conspiring, if you will, to in a way weaken the presidency, if only for a temporary basis. And then of course too, Bush has to now try to compensate for the end of the Reagan administration's weakening with the scandals. I don't mean just the Iran-Contra affair, which showed lack of control, putting it mildly, and putting the best complexion on it, that the president did not run a tight ship, and that people were abusing power, that even if he agreed with what they were doing, that there was no excuse for them doing it on their own. And that was that kind of complaint. The scandal in the Pentagon that went unabated for years and years, the HUD scandal, all of those things Bush now has to, in a way, pay the price for. And so to some degree, we are seeing now that the return of the pendulum. But these are cyclical matters. They're affected by a lot of different things. And so there's certainly some truth to that. I don't want to sound as wishy-washy as that, as I do here, as I may be. But there's truth to the argument but it has to be seen in that perspective. That Reagan did a great deal for the first 6 years of his administration to reestablishing the powers of the presidency and reasserting them. They were always established, but reasserting them. And the Congress was holding its own, too, in certain areas. But now we are seeing certainly a weaker president than Reagan was. I'm not sure, though, that does not necessarily translate to a weaker presidency. That has to do with a lot of other factors. I think what we have to point to, if we look at the weakened presidency as an institution, that's in part a phenomenon of popularity of presidents. If I may throw out, I think, a provocative notion, I think as presidents have become personally more popular, we hear Ted Lowy, political scientist, has written a book entitled, I think, The Personalized or The Personal Presidency. Anyway, his notion is that presidents win election on their own as individuals. They don't need political parties. They set up their own campaign organization. They raise their own money. Formally, the Republicans and the Democrats nominate someone, but it isn't the same as controlling the nomination. The presidents nominate themselves. It's almost as if they are Napoleons grasping the crown out of the hand of the Pope and putting it on their own heads. They do it themselves, and they've been doing it since Roosevelt's time. But political parties have deteriorated. They're weak institutions now. They're ratifiers of people in office. Okay, now that means the presidents become personally powerful, but they don't have to worry then about reinforcing and invigorating their own political parties. If they can win election and get nominated without the political party, they can't they run the government without the political party too? And indeed, political parties have become weaker entities, and that means they have less to rely on, even of their own political party in Congress. Again, as I used the example, I mentioned Reagan came into the White House but did not, in 1981, bring his own political party with him. Eisenhower did it in 1952 when he won election, and then for a short time, 2 years, the Republicans held both houses of Congress. And here was Eisenhower, the man above politics, was still able to kind of come in with a Republican majority, albeit short-lived. Reagan, very much of a media candidate, was unable to bring his own party into both houses of Congress. So, again, further illustration of the weakness of political parties, and that presidents can win by landslides, like Richard Nixon did in 1972. But those are personal landslides. They're not party and institutional landslides. And so the power that presidents in the past used to have deteriorated, the political party being one of them. And the institutional presidency has often been neglected by presidents. They haven't been concerned with that, with building up OMB and its capabilities, or they've been only concerned with short-run tendencies. And they have people serving in office with them for short times. Cabinet officers, not undersecretaries even, or deputy undersecretaries. The top level people in cabinets last 2 years. That's the NAPA study. National Academy of Public Administration did a study, or a survey of the Reagan administration, and found that the top political appointees in the executive branch lasted an average of 2 years. Now, some like George Shultz served 6 years in office, but for the most part, when you look at all of them taken as a whole, that's the average. That obviously has to hurt the president, because there's always a new person coming into office to carry out these responsibilities of the program. So that allows Congress, which is a much more consistent institution, has greater longevity, to gain greater control over the programs and operations. Yes?
How does Congress deal with its members who are inclined to flex the congressional muscle publicly? I have in mind Solars, who during the Tiananmen Square incident gets on the television and says, if the president doesn't do something, we'll do it for him. Which, or Cranston, yeah, now in Warsaw, yeah, carrying on diplomatic.
Doesn't do very much at all, I think that's what my answer is. These are people who have their own power base. Solars heads the Foreign Affairs Subcommittee dealing with the Far East, and is regarded as an expert in that field. And in that case, although certainly the Bush administration did not want him making those statements, he certainly had a right to do so, and in fact was representing Congress. Congress had passed overwhelmingly resolutions, both the House and Senate, almost unanimous resolutions, not only condemning, of course, what happened in the Tiananmen Square, but calling upon the administration to impose harsher sanctions against the communist government in China. And again, these were Republicans and Democrats as well. So it wasn't just a point man like Solars hoisting a trial balloon. He was probably very much reflecting the sentiment of the full Congress. And if there was ever a demonstration of unanimity, but without getting carried away. One of the interesting things about this, it doesn't sound like a lot of restraint for Solars and to Congress to do what I just described, but they did show restraint. They didn't pass a law. They passed a resolution, which all that does is say, we're calling on the administration to do more. You already have power to impose sanctions, and here you are talking now about undercutting the existing sanctions, which is what the Bush administration had hinted at down the line, that despite what the government had done, massacring perhaps as many as 7,000 people in Tiananmen Square, protesting corruption in the government, that the Bush administration was not doing enough. Later we learned from the Bush administration that, unfortunately, we need to deal with the devil, that this government has certain listening posts that they might cut back, that we rely upon in monitoring the Soviet Union, where they have their adjacent borders, and possibility of nuclear testing in the remote areas of the Soviet Union. We need those listening posts. Members of Congress said, we don't need them that badly, and first of all, we don't need them that badly that we have to capitulate to this kind of a government. But secondly, that government hasn't even threatened to remove those listening posts or cut back our access. So we're capitulating to a blackmail situation that doesn't even exist. So that was the argument in Congress. And we had, again, bipartisan, virtual unanimity. I think the vote in the House was 413-2 or something like that, in favor of calling on the administration to impose harsher sanctions. Quite simply, what we're seeing are in cases like this, legitimate differences of opinion. How do you respond to something as atrocious as what the communist government did in China when you, in fact, need to have or maintain some degree of normal diplomatic relations, or where at least your vested interests continue to be tied in with that? How do we deal with South Africa, again, a government or a country that we need for national security reasons, or at least we see we need them for national security reasons, when it's such a discriminatory system of government? In other words, what we have are competing values, competing policies, important policies. Unfortunately, they're not in harmony with one another. They run smash right into one another.
How well informed is the opposition, the knee-jerk response to some of these things that are happening that really require much more depth?
Well, that's why you have oversight. That's why you have congressional investigations to find out what are the policy options. What are we giving up if we, in fact, pursue one policy as opposed to another? And I think in Congress, pretty well informed. You have a lot of consistency. You have a guy like Solars who's been on that committee, and indeed on that subcommittee now for about 8 years. He knows as much about it, I suspect, as most people in the executive branch. That was true too. That doesn't mean we always would necessarily agree with him or that his colleagues agree with him. He's the fellow who had advocated that we provide some military assistance to Cambodian rebels, covert operation. He was roundly criticized by other Democrats on that subcommittee for raising that prospect. They thought he was way off base in that. The administration is hedging its bets on that. It doesn't quite know what to do on that matter because it is aware that there are competing viewpoints. So I would argue Congress, one of the things Congress has done over the past decade and a half has been to try to build up its own independent expertise and capabilities. It's expanded places like the Congressional Research Service, where I work, hired people in that field, expanded the authority and investigative capability of the General Accounting Office. Has improved the caliber of the professional staff on the committees and subcommittees. And it's done so as a way of learning more about public policy so that it can make better judgments about that. And as a result of that, it tends to be more independent. It doesn't have to rely as much on the executive. And that is in part because it got burned too many times. Not by Richard Nixon, it happened before him, of course. This is all these things tended to materialize during the Nixon administration because of, but that was in part because of a whole generation of being misled by previous administrations, Johnson and Kennedy both, and Eisenhower's administration as well, where Congress was kept in the dark about important public policy decisions, and then after they were made or they blew up in our face, or developed some unwanted expectations and or unwarranted expectations and unwanted consequences, we find that Congress finally said enough is enough. We have to develop our own greater independent expertise. I'm reminded, though, to tell you that this is not a new phenomenon. It goes way back in time, and indeed in foreign policy, too. There's a wonderful statement by Senator Vandenberg. Arthur Vandenberg was regarded as the kind of patron saint, if you will, of bipartisanship in foreign policy. He was a Republican leader, as you well know, in the immediate during World War II, and foreign Relations Committee chairman for a short while, and then ranking minority member on that same committee during the Truman administration. We had a great expansion of United States foreign policy programs, and a lot of them, like the United Nations and the Marshall Plan, which relied on bipartisanship support from the Republican Party for these Democratic administration initiatives. Vandenberg, though, felt left out of a number of these important decisions that were being made by Dean Acheson and Marshall and others for the Truman administration. And he thought that he ought to be invited to these colloquies and these discussions, and that Congress, in particular the Republicans, needed to be consulted before the administration went forward with these programs. And Vandenberg was fond, according to his biography, or his collected works compiled by his son, was fond of quoting another Republican and perennial candidate for the presidency, who am I thinking of? Stan Stassen, who said, I don't want to be in on the crash landing unless I can be in on the takeoff. And this is not a new phenomenon where members of Congress have felt left out of the takeoff, but invited to join in picking up the pieces afterwards, after the crash landing. nonetheless, Congress, because of that perception, has tried to develop its greater expertise. But in most areas, it still is very much reliant on the executive for information and policy, setting the agenda and setting the direction.
Perhaps we ought to suggest that if you have further questions, you may, at the same time, you pick up a copy of this excellent article that appeared in the Annals. You may want to ask for personal questions that way. I think we've all learned a lot, and I can guarantee you you'll learn, continue to learn from the article, because it goes into aspects of the problem that carry even further our discussion this morning. It's a terribly important subject, and I'm glad that we've had this opportunity to explore it with a real expert on the subject. Thank you.
Thank you.